This is the way I look at it with respect to U.S. interest rates, and that's a strong pull up and down on the gold price. And it's not the absolute number, if it's negative or if it's positive, it's the direction it's going. They're holding it and buying it for diversification. The issue is that that form of gold purchasing does not go to equities, because the central banks, that phenomenon does not breed this kind of investment. But it does make it better for producers. So what was happening last year was that the gold price really didn't have a big drop when the U.S. interest rates were going to go up, and they did go up. So I've looked at plays in Argentina and Chile, and you can look at Peru as well. Peru has its permitting issues that they're getting through, but Peru's other issue right now is illegal mining, and that's, you know, that helps in terms of why in my travel schedule. Like, I was in Peru last year. That, you know, being on the ground and seeing it happen at site, and also, you know, talking to people at conferences and that, is really a bonus for me in terms of what I do.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Steve Yang, and today we've got one of the most respected voices in the mining and exploration space. Joe Mazumdar is the editor of Exploration Insights, where he helps serious investors understand how to turn rock into money. He's a geologist, an analyst, and one of the sharpest thinkers in the commodity sector. And Joe, it's great to have you on. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, it's quite the intro. I don't know if you were talking about the same guy here, but I'll do my best. I'll do my best to backfill your statement.
Joe, before we start, I want to mention that I saw on your X feed a picture of you on the Stanley Cup. Where was that taken, and who's your pick to win it this year?
This was taken near where I live. I live in West Van. North Van is right nearby, and there was a goaltender that played for the Las Vegas what do they call them, the Golden Knights, and he moved into a neighborhood close by. He let a lot of people know that he was going to have a big party and invited them there, and then I ended up being one of the people there. So yeah, I do have a picture of me in the Stanley Cup. Yes, it's me. It's not a fake account.
Love it. Who's going to win it this year, Joe?
Well, I did 5 Stanley Cups in Edmonton. I did my high school and undergrad there. And I went to the Stanley Cup final a couple of years ago when they lost it in game 7. I was hoping that they might be back again. That would be something. I mean, but my deeply entrenched team, growing up in Winnipeg when we didn't have an NHL team, had been Montreal. And so, that's really my team.
The Canadiens. Awesome. Joe, let's start with the big picture. Gold's been on fire lately. What's really behind the rise? Is it rates? Is it central bank buying? Is it ETF flow into equities? Something else entirely? What's going on?
So this started last year, and it was growing incrementally. And in last year, before the U.S. elections, the interest rates, and this is the way I look at it with respect to U.S. interest rates. And that's a strong pull up and down on the gold price. And it's not the absolute number, if it's negative or if it's positive. It's the direction it's going. And so if the market sees the direction, if it's absolute right now negative, but it's going higher, gold's going to go down. If it is high and people think it's going to go down because the U.S. Federal Reserve is going to start cutting rates, then gold will move up. When that happens, and it's U.S.-led, that bleeds into people buying gold equity ETFs, and that comes down into the sector we, live in. So for me, I mean, that's one thing that's happening, and that's usually what drives a lot of the cycles. But the last couple of years, the last year especially, with post-COVID, people have been diversifying their reserves, countries. and they've been buying more gold. And then with the, you know, with the segmentation in trade, the imposition of tariffs, and people saying, well, you know, why do I need to hold the U.S. dollar if I'm not going to trade with you anyway? And then trying to hold other things. And the other things is majority gold. And so even when the interest rates or the forecast for interest rates was to go lower, and for your viewers, the thing to understand is that gold, you know, does not offer a return. There is no return on gold. You know, gold is constant contango because, you know, you compete against interest rates and also, you know, storage if you had physical gold. Other commodities have what's known as a convenience yield, you know, actually owning copper when copper is very scarce, having it, you know, in your inventory. That's not the case for gold because gold, there's so much gold at the surface. So what happens is that when that real interest rate goes up, the opportunity cost for gold goes up, and then people don't want to hold gold anymore. And when it goes down, the opportunity cost goes down, and then people are interested in gold again. But what's happening now with the central banks, they're holding gold and buying gold for different reasons. They're holding it and buying it for diversification. The issue is that that form of gold purchasing does not go to equities, because the central banks, that phenomenon does not breed this kind of investment. But it does make it better for producers. So what was happening last year was that the gold price really didn't have a big drop when the U.S. interest rates were going to go up, and they did go up. And then with the, you know, the start of the new administration and the tariffs and cutting off ties to some countries, people being having an accelerated potentially diversification policy where they might not have pushed it so far. So you got that underpinning gold. And then at the same time, the U.S. government, you know, doing these tax breaks that would impose even more debt onto the U.S. government, their balance sheets, that debt now is much higher. And then if you have that debt in a higher interest rate environment, suddenly that has become the most, you know, the highest growing cost of the annual budget. You know, one of, you know, it's not the highest because there's entitlements and all this other stuff, but it's higher than the defense budget. And so when it does get over, when the cost of servicing your debt tends to go over the defense budget, that's almost like a decline in empire, you know, and that's just happening now. That $1 billion number is now higher in terms of servicing the debt. And so the U.S. administration really wants to keep that interest rate low. And so when you have that underpinning that, okay, we're going to keep this low. So you have not a dual mandate in trying to keep, you know, semi-full employment and maintain the inflation rate around 2%. None of your triple mandate is trying to keep interest low so the debt service does not exceed potentially the defense budget. So that's another thing that's happening. And so when that speculation comes in, North American gold ETF purchases accelerate, which they have been accelerating. And that's been pushing up the gold price. And then that's also bled into gold equity ETFs. That's bled into the big majors, your Newmonts, your Agnicos, and your Barricks. And then that's coming, and sort of also your royalty companies. And all that sentiment is trickling down into more financings for juniors. That sentiment has increased. Bought deals, money being thrown at people during the Colorado gold shows.
Gotcha. So you travel a lot, I presume. What kind of sentiment are you picking up around the world and from the people you talk to? Is it genuine excitement, maybe a bit overhyped? Is it this kind of same everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, probably like the Colorado gold shows, everybody was really obviously very happy. You know, the signs of a bull market were there in terms of bankers I hadn't seen in a long time actually attending the conference when they usually don't. Salespeople that usually never leave their desk attending the conference. Well, the reason is that they were slamming bot deals in front of these companies, and they needed that extra push. So you see a lot of people, and then also a lot more, you know, hangers-on that were there. So, and also at the Metals Investment Forum that I attended in Vancouver, you know, they had one of their biggest, you know, overall attendance and growth on the online part as well that they just put in post-COVID. And so that's been growing. And so it's not just Vancouver retail, it's other people watching from overseas and other places. And so the sentiment definitely is there. And then I would say, like, where I just was in, I went to a technical conference in Chile, you know, which is more about, you know, copper, a little bit about gold and silver because it's Chile. But they bring in technical talks about deposits from Chile, Argentina, Brazil, Peru, and that. And so I get to sit down and see that. And then I went on 3 site visits. What I did notice is that there are a lot more jobs available now, especially down there. A lot of people changing jobs, you know, a lot of offers happening because as people get more money, they can, you know, engage in bigger programs. Bigger programs need more geologists and people like that. And it's harder to find them.
Joe, for those listeners who have not yet bought gold or are wanting to get into the gold space, and they're wondering whether the train's already left the station. What inning are we in? Are we in the early days, the middle innings? Are we getting late in a real bull market here? Is it a short-term pop? Like, how much room do you think there is to run?
Well, if you go by what's pushing the gold price, it's, you know, central bank demand. Does that, you know, curtail significantly in this current environment? I don't know if it does. But today, as we speak, you know, gold has taken a bit of a tumble because the U.S. and China are meeting about trade, potential tariffs and that. So if you ease the geopolitical climate on tariffs and that, that could have an impact on the rate of diversification, which would be negative for gold. The other thing, does the interest rates suddenly, as opposed to two more cuts over the next, whatever, 3 or 4 months, is that now one? That's really, I think right now there's the higher probability of people have it in their heads or it's baked in the market, it's two. So if that's only one, that would have a negative impact as well. And usually when things run up like that, it tends to fall down harder, but there is a hole there in terms of the diversification part, in terms of, you know, the U.S. government wanting to keep the U.S. dollar, you know, inexpensive relative to other currencies. So there's a lot of that that underpins gold. But again, as you said, you know, nothing goes straight up. What I would do is have it in your head and then pick the companies that you're interested in before that, such that when it does drop like today, you know, and you have 10 to 15% drop in equities, that might be the time to come in. What you would think about is how you would attack this in terms of an investing scheme is how much time do you want to spend studying what you just invested in? Like, it's all nice to say, oh, you know, juniors have a 5 to 10 bagger, but you really got to study that because the only reason it can provide you that return is the underlying risk in it. There is no zero risk, you know, return sort of investment out there. So the higher return, the more work and the higher risk. And so I almost think about it like, you know, if you don't want to spend a lot of time, but you still want exposure, then go for the higher liquidity and make liquidity, you know, correlate to, you know, negatively correlate to how much time you want to spend. If you want to spend more time, then you can go down in liquidity. You can start doing, you know, producers. You can start doing single asset producers. You can get down to developers. You can get down to juniors. It all depends on how much time you want to spend. But if you don't want to spend a lot of time, start with the gold equity ETFs, do the big companies, then the royalty companies, that sort of thing, you know, before you, you know, go, you know, dipping yourself into the junior market.
Gotcha. Joe, let's look beyond gold for a bit. Which commodities are you keeping a close eye on right now? Silver, copper, well, uranium, something else?
Yeah, I haven't gone back into uranium, but that's obviously done well. With the gold price going up, the last few purchases I've had, I've added more silver and silver development, but outside of Mexico. And then I've always had copper. And so because we've had more of a run up on the precious metals, I'm always looking at new copper plays. And I've done really well on a niche market, you know, that exposes me to the fragmentation of the global supply chain. And this would be in rare earths. But that takes a lot of work to find the right people, you know, understand the market, understand, the processing and all that. That's not something you just throw your money at, because niche markets also, they're not very liquid markets. And so the prices can change and they don't trade a lot of these, rare earths. They don't trade in any kind of market that you can see. So you're taking a chance not only on the project, the people and that, but you're also taking a chance on the market.
For silver and copper, they've got strong industrial stories. Do you see, what's your outlook for demand over the next few years?
Well, silver, and half of that is driven by, the gold price. The other part is the underlying industrial demand for silver. And that industrial demand is helped by, those kind of technologies which are considered green and have lower greenhouse gas emissions. I don't know if that's a big deal in the U.S. right now. It is still a big deal in Europe, still a big deal in China. So a lot of the electric vehicle stuff, lithium and that, it's probably plays less well right now, probably in the U.S. than it did prior. That's probably reflected somewhat in the lithium carbonate equivalent price. So what I would say about silver is that it's on the supply side because, Mexico is a big silver producer and, right now the geopolitical climate in Mexico is not great. It's very left wing. They don't have a formal ban on open pits, but there seems to be something going on that they slowed that to a crawl. You can see that in the reaction of companies that change their projects from open pits to underground, or the ones that just leave Mexico altogether, as they have a low grade open pit that can never be converted into an underground, then end up with a project in Ontario or somewhere else. So what I've been doing in silver is trying to look outside of silver. And so I've looked at plays in Argentina and Chile, and you can look at Peru as well. Peru has its permitting issues that they're getting through, but Peru's other issue right now is illegal mining. And that's, that helps in terms of why in my travel schedule, like I was in Peru last year, that, being on the ground and seeing it happen at site and also, talking to people at conferences and that is really a bonus for me in terms of what I do, and not just reading the Bloomberg or Reuters article, but actually seeing what's going on there. But Peru's another big silver producer. And so, for that exposure to silver, I've gone outside because it is a bit of a supply issue in terms of where you're going to get these projects that are needed. So that would be silver. And then in terms of the copper, I'm looking globally. I've got, grassroots in Australia, Kazakhstan, parts of Peru that have been untouched, never drilled. Those are the sort of place I'm looking for on the copper side. And also because copper cathode and that is important for the domestic industry in the U.S. because they don't have the smelting capacity. Those are the sort of things that I would go for, and they're hard to find, but those are the sort of things I would look for. I think about the macro and then try to get exposed to it on a company.
We mentioned that uranium has been one of the best performing sectors. Do you think there's still more upside there? Are we starting to plateau? What are your thoughts on uranium?
I must admit, I haven't been following the uranium market as much. My problem with the uranium market is that there's, how much inventory is out there, which you don't really see. And then who's going to build these, multi-billion dollar projects? Because in Canada, at least, you're not going to allow the Chinese in. Now, the break with the U.S. suggests, they're not investing in Canada. It doesn't look like. So my question, and then we in Canada do not have the tax base to fund these projects like the U.S. So that would be my thinking about the developer projects in Canada, because they're not cheap. And then, so what's Cameco doing? Cameco has taken the punt on, as opposed to building more mega projects that, the capital escalates and the return goes down, go downstream and fill the gap that the Russians have left, in Europe, and find buyers for your uranium, and your uranium products, and that's what they've done, in this market. So yeah, I'm not totally, but the Chinese are still buying uranium projects. So if you have a uranium project in Africa or somewhere like that, because they can't buy one in Australia, they can't buy it in Canada, or obviously not the U.S. So they have to pick where they can buy it. And most of that's happening in places like Africa.
Joe, if I know that you invest in a lot of, I think you're a big nickel investor as well. You mentioned rare earth. Is there like a favorite commodity that you go on? This is probably one of the most underappreciated right now. Like, is there one where we're not putting as much value as we should?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big nickel guy, because I wrote an article 2 years ago, why the nickel market sucks. They got a lot of play in Sudbury, apparently. The issue with nickel is that, the Indonesians, they can't keep producing at the pace that they're producing. And they're also right now, canceling a lot of permits because of the environmental damage that, some of these mines are having on the islands in Indonesia. So with that, and then BHP curtailing production and some of these other guys curtailing production, it reminds me a bit of the copper market when I joined Phelps Dodge in the 2000s. We had curtailed production. Codelco had been stockpiling copper. BHP had curtailed production, and then you're waiting for the turnaround. And so in that environment, it's nice to get, a project that you like that's high grade that could live through a first quartile sort of cost basis, and strategically in a place that, would want that metal, like the U.S. or something like that. And that's one that I'm interested in. And also PGMs. We see what's happening with the platinum market. Platinum has actually outperformed gold. That will go back from platinum and palladium, because as platinum runs up, just like what we saw with palladium running up several years ago, is that then the other metal plays catch up, because then you see substitution. And so I've got exposure to PGMs as well, just for that phenomenon. And so any kind of commodity, if you can get it cheap with a good management team, good asset in the right jurisdiction, you just hold those, and wait for the market to turn, because that the management team will do the right thing in terms of cost control and capital structure and that, writing out, the bad times. On a contrarian basis, that might be the play to make if you think you've missed the gold market.
Joe, you mentioned jurisdiction, management team, and finding something for cheap. When you're evaluating a company, how do you balance people, project, and price? Do they carry equal weight? Do you find that one usually drives your decision?
Yeah, I mean, usually, like, sometimes, like, when I started doing this, I would be all about the asset because, you know, I came from big companies and it was all about the asset because management doesn't matter because you end up being management. You know, and if we're interested in the jurisdiction, you know, you can throw that out the window. So, you know, it'd be very specific. And that you can't do that when you invest in companies because, you know, I don't end up owning the asset. I end up owning a share of the company that owns the asset. And so if you think about it that way, you have the numerator, which is the asset. Mm-hmm. And then you have the denominator, which is the share count. And then the most important part is the management that's managing both the numerator and the denominator. If you have a good numerator with respect to asset, but you have a poor management team, then the risk is that they'll blow out the denominator. And so you'll never make any money because you're investing in shares. So managing not only the asset, but also the capital structure is very important. So you can never get around. That's key. And the asset that they have at that moment may not be the asset that actually, you know, drives the value later. They might find something else, you know? So I've had that a few times where it wasn't that asset that actually made it move. It was something else, but the management team realized that and they moved quickly. Another management team might not move that quickly and stay pounding the same rock for a long time and just hoping for the market to, you know, and then, you know, doing a full 5-year warrant or something like that just to get another couple million bucks. So that, you know, so management is definitely a key, but there can be managements that, you know, have some success and then get delusional and then start working in maybe an asset or a commodity or a jurisdiction that, you know, I'm not going to touch. So that kind of management then doesn't matter to me.
Joe, is there something that retail investors consistently get wrong about exploration stocks? I mean, and along with that, if you can tell me what kind of companies, someone new to the junior mining space should avoid, are there like red flags that you see over and over again that people miss?
Yeah, I would say, you know, I still, you know, that people think the more ounces, the better. The problem is that you don't know the quality of those ounces. And, somebody said, oh, these guys got 10 million ounces. So that company has got to be better than this company. And they're trading very low. And then he goes, well, what's going to move that stock? Finding another 2 million ounces? No, they probably already hit that critical mass. And now they got to add value to those ounces they already have. How do they do that? Then you look at it. It's usually because they're very low grade. They, you know, and then you go, well, maybe metallurgically, they might be problematic. Or infrastructurally, it's in the middle of nowhere. And then you go, or they have a problem with social license to operate. So those are sort of the red flags you got to go through. And you go, well, why is this thing so cheap? Mm-hmm. And it might stay cheap for a long time because there's another thing that you're missing that you don't see in the presentation. Because when I look at a presentation, I'm not looking at what they're telling me. I'm looking at what they're not telling me. And that's when I dig into the technical report, if I think it's worth looking into. You know, what's nice about, the environment is because I've been around a bit, you know, with certain management teams, I just filter out the company. I won't even read the technical report. I won't even look at the presentation. But if something's of interest and it's worth looking into, then you go a little bit deeper and then start hunting for these red flags.
Joe, we like to talk about our wins, but we don't typically talk about our mistakes, but you know, those tend to be the best teaching tools. Can you share a mistake that you've made that, you know, really shaped, you know, your philosophy, your approach on investing or analysis today?
Well, I've had a number of mistakes, and it's usually selling too early. But in the letter, you know, I try to maintain like 20 companies. About that. And so if I'm bringing somebody in, I got to take somebody out. And if somebody has not been performing very well, you know, I can't have that stagnant, you know, hold forever. And so I will pitch some. And I've had some that I've pitched that, you know, within 6 months, they've had significant turnaround. And some of them haven't, obviously. But it's hard to pick. I mean, like Trilogy Metals, you know, when they got their permit taken away and the road. And then I said, you know, because I talked about this with subscribers recently, I said, well, at that point, I had already said that, you know, under a different U.S. administration, the stock could turn around. And I just basically said I should have taken my own advice, because then that stock went from, you know, whatever it went to, and added about $700 million of market cap overnight. You know, once, you know, for what, you know, and then that was just a private placement by the Department of War into it. But it gave everybody the impression that this project was going to get permitted, you know, this was going to happen, everything is going well. But to add that much market cap overnight was significant. Yeah, you know. So, you know, in that instance, I should have taken my own advice. Because if there was a stock out there in my sort of universe that was levered to the U.S. administration change, you know, that would have been, that is, was, continues to be the stock.
Joe, I listened to an interview you did recently about, I forget the title of it, but it said something like surviving the bull market. What advice could you give someone who's building a commodity portfolio today?
Yeah, I would say the surviving the bull market comes about that it's harder to differentiate the wheat from the chaff now. And, you know, everybody's got capital thrown in front of them. They have work programs. They have news flow. You know, so a lot of things are happening, lots of more news, you know, because it's all funded, and a lot more, you know, newsletter writers and all these other people talking about companies, and it's all in your face. So the problem now is trying to actually pick that winner, because, you know, there's a lot more, let's say, wolves and sheep's clothing, or the other way around. So that's the problem right now. And so stock picking is harder, definitely harder, because now the capital constraint and the filtering doesn't exist. Everybody's getting money. Before, when the market is not so buoyant, then the bankers in that can't find capital for everybody. You know, and then you can see, well, I got to pick these guys because I know they've got deep pockets. They've got these certain shareholders in that. And in this environment, it matters probably a little less. Because now retail and some other people are in there funding these projects.
So I heard someone say, maybe it was, I forget who it was, Rick Rule maybe. Basically,
probably
one of, I forget what the fraction was, but like, I don't want to attribute something to Rick that he didn't say, but like, I would agree that most companies out there are crap.
Yep.
Right. So, but when the tide rises, like they look really good. Is there?
Yeah, I mean, I think Rick once said that, you know, don't confuse intelligence with a bull market. And that's what we're in right now. Mm-hmm. So if you really want an alpha return, not a beta return, because you can get a beta return without even thinking about it by buying the GDXJ. But if you want an alpha return, that still takes work. But in this market, the work is even harder, if that makes sense, because everything's moving. And then the other kind of thing you got to think about is, because I bought things that I thought, oh, yeah, well, you know, that's kind of pricey. But I thought, well, this is a good team. There's not too many assets out there like this. It was a bit of a supply and demand for equity. And I thought, well, I'll buy that. You know, that's more than doubled in the interim, you know, because the market's more buoyant. But then you think, like, in terms of other people who are coming down and investing in this sector, they made a lot of money from artificial intelligence and other things, and then they're investing in this sector. They need a certain amount of liquidity before they even look at it.
Mm-hmm.
So your little junior miner with a 30 million market cap is not what they're going to see first. They're going to go, well, I can't invest in it until it's at least $1 billion. So those guys that are sort of creeping into the billion, you know, are now getting a different lift by these other guys that are now seeing them and investing in them, you know, which they weren't there before. But they're all saying like, oh, you know, the market, I need another undercapitalized sector, you know, with significant growth potential, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then they say, oh, the mining sector. And I don't even have to convince them. They're talking to me about it. And they're, you know, I go, well, yeah, wow, that's great. But then they say, well, it's got to have at least this kind of market cap for me to even touch it. And because a lot of these companies had not been performing very well, you know, coming into this buoyant market, they wouldn't see that kind of investment. But now, since they've actually moved up, now those other people can actually look. So don't get put off by the market cap sometimes. If it's the right team in that, and you still think the gold price is going to move, stick to good teams.
Joe, I know that you mentioned your letter briefly. Before we get in a little bit more into that, can you share a couple companies or projects that you find interesting right now, and what exactly is catching your eye about them?
Well, I would say the U.S. ones, because of the U.S. administration accelerating permitting. That's something to consider. I mean, one of those would be like Liberty Gold. I mean, it's low grade, but it's heap leach. It's run of mine, so that's lower cost, lower capital intensity. Southern Idaho, there's no trees. So even though you have to deal with the U.S. Forestry Service and the Bureau of Land Management, it was an old mine site as well. They have access to water, which is essential nowadays. Great team. John Gilligan worked at Marigold. I knew him. The first time I met him was back in the 90s when he worked for BHP at Escondida. He's been around for a while. But, you know, that's the kind of people you need when you're running these technical projects. It was led by a good team. They have a strategic investor now. Centerra Gold came in and now owns 9.9% of the company, which, sort of a good stamp of approval in terms of what the company is doing. And in this current environment of the U.S. administration, and they're mostly on federal ground, permitting should be easier. Because another company that I have, Headwater Gold, which is not in development, it's grassroots exploration. They have a project, Spring Peak, with Newmont in Nevada in the Walker Lane Belt. They just got onto the Fast 41. I mean, I don't know why, because right now they don't even have a resource, as far as I'm aware. That's a positive. If these kind of projects get it, I mean, why shouldn't Liberty get it? And then also on the copper side, the cathode producer that I like, potential producer developer, Arizona Sonora in Arizona, that just put out their pre-feasibility study just yesterday. You know, and they have also a strategic investor in Hud Bay, who is pushing for more exposure to Arizona because they already have copper. Arizona Sonora is a bit different than other projects because they have gone out of their way not to be exposed to federal permitting. So they've been acquiring private. They have access to water, but they've changed their mine plan from mostly 50-50 open pit underground to 80 to 90% open pit, lower technical risk. And that's what the PFS is showing right now. So those are a few companies because in this current environment for permitting and that, the U.S. really does look positive.
Joe, thank you for sharing that. Is there any way you can tell us a little bit more about the Exploration Insights? Kind of give us an overview of what that is, the kind of work that you do, and how people can access your research.
Yeah, it's explorationinsights.com is the website. It's a weekly publication. We take 4 weeks off a year. I travel a lot and the site visits really gain and provide more data for the insights that we write about every week. We have a portfolio of anywhere from 18 to 22 companies, and they range in commodities, range in stage. What I talk about every week is what's happening with them. You know, here's new news. What's my sentiment on that news? Is that good, bad? Do I sell? Do I keep it? Whatever. And then when I add one, I do a big, report on that individual, why I added it and what I probably had to take out because of it. And a lot of these times it's not negative on the company that I'm selling. Sometimes it is. I've had a few of those. And I tell people what I'm buying before I buy it in the market. The publication comes out, not when markets are open, it comes out on Sundays. And then if I'm buying, I'll buy that week. And if I'm selling, I do the same thing. So that, that's basically, I make money from the subscribers and from hopefully the portfolio. And that's how it works. I mean, there's free stuff on the website. There's interviews like yours that'll pop up. Follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter for or X with respect to what I do and that. And every now and then when I get up the gumption, I do post some of my notes on site visit. But I try to make sure I leave the insights for the letter and for paying subscribers.
Joe, this has been excellent. I appreciate your thoughts on all that's been going on. For everyone watching, check out Exploration Insights. I will include Joe's links below.
Thanks very much for the invitation, Steve.
All right, Joe. Hope to have you again.
Bye. All right. Cheers.